I will call this meeting of the Children and Family Finance and Policy Committee to order. And first, a word from the Sergeant's Office. I, the committee chair, maintain control of these proceedings and...
Sometimes.
True. As of right now, you just... Come on.
I, the committee chair, maintain control of these proceedings and establish the following expectations.
Signs and placards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause or any audible demonstrations, even if I like what you're doing, are not allowed. For safety reasons, standing and sitting in the walkways, aisles, or standing or obstructing at your chair is prohibited. If you require any accommodation, please ask our sergeant staff, who is wearing a gold tie and probably defending the door, is my guess. They will happily help you out. Troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. Those providing testimony will be given time limits and they will be observed. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it as it'll be required for re-entry into the hearing room. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in removal from the hearing room. Our goal is to conduct these proceedings efficiently while ensuring everyone the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. All right. So today we are going to be hearing a proposal on child care licensing and quality that we've talked about in this committee over the last few years. Is this the order we're doing it? We do have a quorum. I guess. Chair Cattisi-Batun, do you want to move the minutes?
So moved.
Thank you. Any discussion on the minutes from February 18th, 2026? Seeing none, all of those say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Now we'll move on to our presentation on child care licensing. So I'd like to invite Dr. Nicole Smurillo, and Eric Moss is on Zoom. So we'll start with Dr. Smurillo. And then after this presentation, we will have the department up to answer some questions, and maybe there will be new questions from this presentation. So please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dr. Nicole Smurillo, and I'm the Director of Data, Research, and Policy at Think Small. Today, I am here to present some recommendations that resulted from a long engagement process that Think Small led with many members of the early care and education community here in Minnesota. We engaged deeply with 40 early care and education providers, as well as experts from the field, and then also drew on information and feedback we were getting from throughout Minnesota. We went to presentations, listening sessions, town halls, and various places to try to get this information out and truly get feedback from the field. So what I'm presenting to you today is a set of recommendations. It is in no way what will finally come out of this process. We do want to just say that this is what the group that we met with and the feedback that we got came up with as recommendations for how to move the field of early care and education forward in Minnesota. We do want to say from the outset that we recognize that we are building on great strengths here in Minnesota. We have the work of the Great Start Task Force, which set a blueprint for how to move the field forward. We also have the Parent Aware redesign that is underway, and as well as child care licensing and modernization is underway. And then also we have a legacy of great policymaking in the early care and education field here in Minnesota. So we recognize that and we want to move those works forward. Okay, I'm going to be coming at you with a lot of information today. So I want to start with just giving you some high-level takeaways to guide your understanding today. The first thing that I want you to take away is from the first recommendation that in the field of early care and education here in Minnesota, there should be clear and funded options for childcare for families, and that the funding that these options receive should be commensurate with the expectations that the state has of those types of programs. The recommendations also highlight that there should be the creation of a Minnesota Board of Early Care and Education that would have real power sharing with those closest to children having power. And we'll get into details of all of these in a few moments. And then the third main high-level takeaway is that we would like to see licensing further reduced and more focused on health and safety, and quality would move to profession-led recognition system with multiple quality pathways. So we want to see streamlined pathways with right-sized licensing and supports aligned with the expectations that the state has of these different types of programs. So those are the high-level takeaways. Let's get into the details. So if we talk about clear and funded program options for families, we see it as there being three types or three buckets of programs, and these map onto what exists today. The first type would be trusted caregivers, and trusted caregivers are similar to what we know as FFN, or family, friend, and neighbor. So this could be someone, a relative, someone down the block, or someone like a nanny. And the idea here is that this is unregulated care, so we retain a place in our system for unregulated care. These programs would receive some public funding, but it would be less than other types, and families would decide on health and safety of the programs and on quality of the program. So families would decide, is this a level of health and safety I'm comfortable with, and is this the quality that I want for my child? The second type of program would be health and safety licensed. And that's similar to exactly what it sounds like. These programs would be licensed by the state for health and safety. And so what the state would be doing here is assuring health and safety to the family, and then families would still decide, is this the level of quality that I want for my child, the type of quality? And these programs would receive more funding than trusted caregivers in order to meet those health and safety standards, but they would still receive less than the third type that I will tell you about. The third type of program is recognized early care and education programs. So this type would be licensed for health and safety, but also the providers that are in a recognized early care and education program would go through a formal pathway to have the quality in their program recognized, and the state would recognize that pathway. And these pathways will be determined by a board, which I mentioned and we'll talk about in a moment, but just kind of keep that in your mind. This type of program would receive the highest level of public funding in order to meet the health and safety requirements, as well as in order to go down the quality pathway that they choose. Okay. So I put extra slides in here just for your knowledge. When we're beyond this presentation, I'm not necessarily talking about all the slides. So we're going to skip to this slide with an infographic where we have a recommendation number 2 would be the creation of the Minnesota Early Care and Education Board. And who is the board? So the board would be made up of providers, families, early care and education experts. They would hold real decision-making power, and they would have responsibilities that affect the field in Minnesota. What would the board do? The board would do a few things. The group sees their responsibilities as falling into three main categories. The first would be quality. So the board would set program quality expectations and curate approved pathways. So it would be up to the board to determine what are the appropriate pathways or the pathways that work for the field in Minnesota for programs to show and demonstrate their quality. The hope of the group is that accreditation would be one of those, but it would be one of many. We would also like to see that there is a space for innovative pathways, things we haven't thought of yet, because we know our field, especially here in Minnesota, we are always progressing, we're always moving forward and thinking of new things, so we want to leave space for the future. The board would also look at professional qualifications, because you may know that professional qualifications have been removed from licensing. And so we would like to see that educator and program leader standards are covered in our system, and this is a place that we see that those could be covered. The board would also work to think about program supports and level of funding. They would provide the direction on necessary levels of funding to accomplish what the types of programs are responsible for, what level of funding is needed to achieve health and safety licensing, what level of funding is needed to do these different quality pathways, and they would give support and advice on those levels of funding. And then the board would also monitor and publicly report on the impact of policies on child outcomes, program supply, and workforce stability. Okay. So there are a few facets of quality and what the board, the group recommends as far as quality pathways, and this idea of a profession-led quality system with multiple program quality pathways. But first, the first facet, and I want to be clear because this has been confusing in other presentations we've given, we do see this future state as one in which parent aware does not exist in its current state, and that it is replaced by a profession-led quality system. So in this profession-led, industry-led quality system, which includes multiple pathways, we would want to see first, in order to get to that goal, we would want to see right-sized licensing. So in the current reality, licensing can be unclear and punitive. There are many variances given, so even what exists in licensing isn't always what happens practically. The purpose of licensing is often not clear, particularly to providers that we spoke with. And we believe that the purpose of licensing is health and safety, assuring the health and safety of children. So we would like to see further reduction in the number of standards that are included in licensing, and that licensing standards would focus more on health and safety and less on quality. So what would be included in there? And we have a process that we've developed that would be recommended for selecting what licensing standards kind of remain. So those would be, look at health and safety standards such as ratios, hazard-free environments, things related to basic child development, behavior management, supervision, and then other multiple health and safety topics. And then any standards that remain, we would like, and we're not looking to deregulate, we are looking to right size. So I just wanted to make sure we clear that up. We are looking to make licensing the right size for the field now in a way that's implementable, because the thing that we keep running into is that a lot of times the standards that remain in licensing, they're not implementable. So we need the standards that remain to be implemented, and they need to be implementable in houses where we have childcare and also in childcare centers, and that they would be clearly and consistently implementable. Okay. Then we'd like to see that there are multiple pathways to quality recognition. We really see the need for more than one credible way to show quality. Right now, we all know, kind of, what it takes to go from a parent aware one star to a parent aware four star. There are no other ways. It is the only way. And if that does not work for your program, you really don't get the opportunity to have your quality recognized. And so we'd like to see the board approve multiple pathways to quality recognition. So again, like I mentioned, we would like to see that this would include accreditation, not one accreditation. There are multiple accreditations that are great. And map on to what the field tells us is really important for children. But then we also see that there are programs that accreditation doesn't work for them. And so we'd like to leave a place for innovation where programs can have other ways to show their quality. The board can develop and help work with programs to develop other ways for programs who might just not fit into that accreditation pathway to be able to have their quality recognized. We would also like to see that all pathways require holistic standards, comparable evidence, and validation. And we feel the result would be quality recognized across diverse program models and communities. And then part of this is also a clear way, roadmap, of how you get from being a health and safety licensed program to a recognized early care and education program. Obviously, that's not something that happens overnight. So we want a place in the system for programs who have committed to working on it, who have selected a pathway that works for their program, or who are working on developing a pathway for their program. There needs to be a place for them as well. So we see this roadmap as kind of going from health and safety licensed, where you could stay, and then ECE candidate, that we would like to see it as a time-limited designation. And then a recognized early care and education program where they've chosen a pathway, they've done it, but then we also think it's really important that quality recognition is not just a destination. We want quality to be a journey, just like I'm invested in my profession to continue to get better at what I do. We see the same thing as being important for early care and education providers, that they would continue to be invested in and continue to have supports in order to improve their quality as they go and improve their practice. And then a part of this, of course, is aligned supports. We want to see what we've been told by educators is the current landscape of supports is very confusing. It's a never-ending maze. There's people that just miss out on different opportunities because they just don't know about them because there's just so many different ways that they can get supports. So we'd really like to have mapped onto these different types of programs, the different types of supports that are available to them, and have that be much clearer. We want, we would like to see that they get the right amount of funding to fund the type of program that they are, and that the board would oversee a lot of this. So. Okay, and that is all that I have for you today, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Individuals here, right or left?
Anything to add to the presentation?
I think I would just like to make sure that it's. I'm sorry. Yes. And should we continue with our testimony or just add to your presentation?
Not your testimony. Okay. Just comments on that.
Thanks. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, my name is Shauna Marianovich, and I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Montessori Network today to offer some testimony. Regarding this presentation, I would just like to highlight the way this presentation came across may not have illustrated what we all did to contribute to creating it. After so many years put into advocating with our agencies and many deep partnerships in there, this process felt really different because we were welcomed to the table with a clean and open slate to understand what everybody's expertise was. And so that the results that you see here really truly were developed from individuals coming from the field and from proximity experts that could bring forward new ideas that really met Minnesotans where they were and didn't have any preconceived notions of what that status quo was.
I think that's all, Mr. Chair.
All right, can you hear me now?
I'll be turning my mic on. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay, thank you. So you can hear me. Sorry, I've got technical challenges here this morning. I am going to be off screen as I'm also watching children. I am Cindy Cunningham, a licensed family child care provider in St. Paul for almost 30 years. I also am privileged to be the public policy chair for Meeting Care, the 501c3 Statewide Association for Licensed Family Child Care. I appreciate the opportunity to testify virtually, even though not on screen, and thank the committee staff for making this happen. We ask that future bill hearings of both Modernization Project and We Vision be given evening hearings to ensure that license holders, those doing the work, have the opportunity to testify. I participated in the We Vision tech team as part of the process, which also included a separate licensed family child care provider group that included about a dozen providers statewide. I'm here to share how family child care providers like myself and others who participate in this process see these recommendations and why they believe that this is the first time in a long time that our voices are truly reflected in a proposal. In fact, at the end of the proposal, when the licensed family child care provider worker was asked to rate each recommendation on a scale of 1 to 5, no individual gave any recommendation of score lower than 4. As you know, I've been the public policy work for a long time. I have been on countless committees and task forces, always hoping that this will be the one that sticks. Too often feeling like I and other providers have offered clear constructive feedbacks and watching decisions move forward that don't match the feedback. So this proposal jumped out of a national program. This work has been done by Minnesota Early Childhood Educators. And that includes that the national organizations for the accredited programs have not been involved with this. We, as Lead in Care, strictly saw that we needed to have a Minnesota model because we don't see that the national organization truly reflects what we do in family child care in Minnesota, hence some of the move towards the board's approach. The separation of health and safety licensing from quality improvement directly reflects provider feedback. What they asked for was a system where licensing focuses on a clear set of health and safety expectations and quality practices. This is exactly what these recommendations propose. Providers feel that this gives them the flexibility they need to really tailor their programs to the children and families that we serve. Second, the emphasis on multiple pathways to demonstrate quality comes straight from what family child care providers have said they needed. The recommendation to create multiple board-approved recognition pathways while still holding high shared standards is a direct response. It allows providers to show quality in ways that are honest to their model instead of being forced into a mold that doesn't fit. Third, the tone of growth-oriented accountability instead of peer-based enforcement is exactly what we have asked for. Providers in the process spoke about how hopeful it felt to see a framework that means the problem, that time is pulled away from children by compliance and then proposes accountability, the trust relationship, coaching, and peer support to lead to better outcomes. Providers have said that they want to be set up for success instead of failure. Fourth, the proposed board response to a longstanding need to be part of decision-making, not just advisory. We wanted an ongoing structure where family child care providers share power with others on the front line, setting standards, approving quality pathways, and guiding support. The board envisioned here is the answer to that request. It doesn't treat our participation as a one-time consult. It builds our roles into the governance of the system. Providers in our industry are tired. Some are counting down the years or months until closing their businesses because the current system feels unsustainable and disrespectful of their professionalism. I ask that you all see these recommendations not as a perfect final product, but a real and honest reflection of what family child care providers have been saying they need for years, a framework that gives us a chance to keep us doing their work in Minnesota for children and families and the economy. We, like other professionals, bring experience and expertise and do not need to be micromanaged in order to do our job. We ask that you view us in this manner. If you start with less regulation and a clear health and safety floor and then give this industry room to breathe, I believe you will be amazed at what family child care providers and others can offer when the shackles are removed and their professionalism is taken seriously. I think you will potentially see more family child care providers than that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cunningham. We'll go to Maria Harms on Zoom as well. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. Thank you. It is a pleasure to see you all again and be here today. My name is Maria Harms, and I operate the only child care center in my 882-square-mile county, located in Redwood Falls, with the capacity to serve 79 children. I have a degree in business and child development and a master's in education administration with principal and superintendent licensures. I chose this field because I wanted to be both a mother and a working professional serving children and families. What I've learned in this industry is our current structure is breaking and breaking the very people it depends upon. First, licensing regulations are smothering. Licensing is essential for children's safety. I support that wholeheartedly. But the way we currently overproduce rules and mix safety rules with quality expectations creates a pit that providers fall into. You have to fit the mold, deviating, even to innovate, comes with risk. On any given day, I'm responsible for staff coverage, family communication, budgets, and emotional needs of both children and adults. My teachers already wear several hats a day. I do not expect them to memorize the 300-page licensing rulebook the way I must as an owner and director, though I too am human and always leave room for human error. Because of the professional load teachers must carry, I have not pursued additional ratings or accreditations for quality within my center. Not because I don't value quality, but because layering another system on top of a heavy and sometimes inconsistent licensing environment doesn't feel sustainable for my staff or my business. The burnout rate for providers is very high in this industry, and layering more and more on their shoulders will cause them to break. It's just a matter of when. The recommendations in the We Vision model recognize this by clearly separating health and safety licensing from quality recognition systems and by aligning supports to pathways programs actually choose. This model is a more realistic and sustainable way to maintain safety and promote quality without burning people out in the process. Second, who wrote the rules and why the board matters? During the licensing modernization conversations, which I was very active in, I asked what felt like a simple question: who wrote our current rules? Where did these specific requirements come from? And no one could give me a clear answer. That's the deeper issue. Many of the people shaping my day-to-day reality have never actually run a program or been responsible for a classroom. On paper, rules like a certain number of blocks per child in each room may make sense to someone, but in practice, especially for outdoor-focused or mixed-age environments, they can be misaligned. As I've heard and said, you don't renovate a house you've never walked through and tell me where the bathroom should go. The recommendations respond to this thought process by proposing a board on which early educators, providers, and program leaders hold real authority to define quality standards and approve recognition pathways for the industry they work in. That means future rules and expectations will be informed by people who actually know what it takes to run a program day to day. These people are on the ground, not looking at it from a 5,000-foot view. Third, this model will be breaking down silos between program types. Our current structure reinforces silos: centers over here, family child care over there, school-based programs, and Head Start in their own lanes. Each is subject to different rules, different expectations, funding streams, and different support systems, even though we're all providing safe care for children. So why? This We Vision framework instead talks about early care and education programs. Regardless of whether they are in homes, centers, or schools, all programs fall under one title. Families see clear options, and quality is defined consistently across those options by the families choosing the care. For providers, it means we're no longer talking past each other. Center directors, family child care providers, school-based leaders can sit at the same table, under the same board, working from the same shared standards. That's how you build a true mixed delivery system that is understandable to families and professionals within the field. Lastly, making the work sustainable for the people with the heart for the industry. No one I know is in the field for the money. People choose early childhood because they have a heart for young children and their families. But heart isn't enough to keep qualified people when the system remains fragmented, punitive, and unsustainable. I've had parents tell me they feel like they're signing away their parental rights with huge stacks of forms, while providers know one mistake could undo years of work. These recommendations aim to keep health and safety at the forefront while shifting the tone of the rest of the system from policing to partnership through growth-oriented accountability, coaching, and clear profession-led expectations. That's how we keep centers like mine open, keep experienced educators in the classroom, and keep parents confident in what they're making a good choice for their children. In closing, Minnesota asks a great deal from its early childhood providers. These recommendations don't lessen our responsibility. They make it more coherent, more honest, and more sustainable. They give us a system where rules make sense on the ground, where quality is defined with us, not for us, and where families can finally see clearly what their options mean. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we will go to Candace Yates and Sherry Teagues after that.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair West and members. Good afternoon. My name is Candace Yates, and I'm the Executive Director of Child Care Aware of Minnesota. My career spans over 20 years. I've been an early educator and center director. I've coached programs through quality improvement. And today I lead an organization that supports early educators and programs across the state. I'm also a parent of three children, of which two live with cognitive disabilities. So I have experienced and understand this system from multiple vantage points. I've worked inside it, I've supported others navigating it, and I've relied on it as a parent who needed it to work. That perspective shapes how I see these recommendations. For years, I've held a strong and simple belief. If a program is working to implement quality practices, they should have access to the support they need all the time. Not just at a certain time-restricted point in a rating cycle, it should be continuous. Right now, too many supports are tied to being in a specific recognition process at a specific point in time. Early educators tell us all the time, I keep getting referred somewhere else. I can't find what I need. A lot of the supports show up as more work for me, which you've heard other people say, and they're not actually support. So this, from my perspective, is not growth oriented accountability. Like Maria said, it's fragmentation. So these recommendations align support with quality pathways themselves. If programs commit to a recognition pathway, coaching, mentoring, and peer networks are built in as a part of how accountability works. Accountability stops being something done to early educators and becomes something they willingly engage in with support. And that is how you improve practice in a lasting way. One of the clearest insights from the process is that Minnesota needs what we call a shared floor for quality. A clear, agreed upon a set of expectations for what we mean when we say effective programs before we can successfully build any type of specialized support on top of that. Right now, we're making small adjustments to an aging structure, a tweak to rules here and there, adding a pilot, a new requirement layered onto the old ones. Each change causes disruption, but how the underlying system functions doesn't change. Like Maria also said, it's like repeatedly renovating one room in a house whose foundation hasn't been stabilized. These recommendations instead propose what I call building out the block. Licensing that is clearly anchored in health and safety, profession-led quality standards, multiple recognition pathways, and supports aligned to those pathways. Once that foundation exists, then we can meaningfully design and fund specialized supports. For example, pathways and coaching for programs that do serve medically fragile children or children with disabilities, which were consistently things that were raised during this process. As a parent of children with disabilities, I know how inadequate the current system can sometimes feel. Too often, families are navigating one-off solutions and personal workarounds. This framework gives us a way to build a systematic support, not ad hoc fixes. We all know additional public investment is needed, and with investment does come scrutiny and change. The real question is whether the system will evolve. It's not whether the system will evolve. It will. The question is who shapes that evolution. So these recommendations say clearly program leaders, early educators, and families should not experience change as something imposed on them. They should help define quality, shape supports, and guide accountability. The proposed board for early care and education is the structure that makes this possible. Other professions already do this. Nurses set nursing standards through professional boards, so early educators deserve the same opportunity to set standards through a board that includes them. If we don't create a formal structure for field leadership, we will continue to experience change the way we always have, through mandates layered onto an already strained workforce, and we know what follows: burnout, permanent exits, and mistrust. These recommendations welcome accountability that actually fit the work and build structure that allows the field to lead, not just react. Right now, we have multiple funding streams, multiple initiatives, and multiple program improvement efforts. They are all very well-intentioned, but we do not have a clear, unified answer to a basic question. Is this investment producing better outcomes for children, greater stability for families, and a stronger workforce? The board envisioned in these recommendations would have explicit responsibility to monitor and publicly report on how policies and investments affect child outcomes, programs, supply, and workforce stability. That matters. It prioritizes and organizes supports based on impact, not on what is easiest to administer. It gives legislators and public and the public clarity about what their investment is achieving, and it ensures that improvement efforts are aligned rather than fragmented. I believe this is responsible stewardship. We are in a fragile moment right now. Programs are closing, the workforce is strained, and families are still struggling to find care. These recommendations don't eliminate those pressures overnight, but they do give Minnesota something we have not had yet: a coherent structure to invest in, to hold accountable, and to improve over time. From my perspective, as someone who has coached educators, led systems change, and relied on the system as a parent, this is the shift from patchwork to establishing a foundation we can build on. Thank you.
Thank you. Sherry Teagues is next on the list. Maybe I'm butchering that last name.
Oops.
Oh, she's on Zoom. Okay, there we go.
Good afternoon, Chairman West and members of the committee. My name is Sherry Teagues. I live in Stevens County in West Central Minnesota. I have a BA in child development, and I have worked in early childhood education for about 40 years. In preschool and ECFE, I've been a center teacher and a director. I'm a Minnesota-approved trainer and course writer. I am a four-star Parent Aware rated licensed family child care professional, and I'm also a grandmother. So I've seen our field from almost every angle. What stood out to me in this process was how quickly people across very different settings agreed on one simple truth: quality has to fit the families we serve and the culture that we live in. It is not just a checklist. When someone said that in one of our first meetings in the work group that I was in, you could see people nodding in their screens. Everyone had examples where current systems missed that mark. In my own work, I've watched providers struggle to offer nature-based programs, farm-based experiences, and culturally grounded care because the regulations and quality measures were written with a different kind of program in mind. At the same time, I've met parents across the state who have told me, I don't like some of the things that they do in the program that my children are in, but I don't feel like I can speak up because there's nowhere else to go. Those two stories, providers trying to offer something unique and parents feeling they have no choices, tell you our system is not aligned with real life. The recommendations being discussed today would move us in a much better direction. They keep licensing focused on what they do best, protecting children's health and safety. They create a separate professional-led structure for quality with multiple credible pathways so that different kinds of programs can show what they do well as long as they meet those shared standards. That means a nature-based family childcare program, a center in a small town, and a school-based program in a city can all be recognized for quality in ways that make sense for them and for the families that they serve. The other piece that gives me hope is the proposed board that we've been talking about. where people who actually do the work, family child care professionals, center staff, parents, and other experts would have a real say in early childhood issues. You don't spend 40 years in a field without putting in your share of time in committees and listening sessions and task forces or filling out surveys. We've all experienced having our feedback disappear into large institutions, like, no offense, like the legislature. Many times after these sessions conclude, decisions go back to being made far away from classrooms and family child care programs. A standing board keeps the field at the table before changes happen, instead of fighting on the backside after the fact. I believe in licensing, and I believe in high expectations. But I also believe we should be setting educators and providers up for success, not failure. These recommendations do that by clarifying roles, honoring different models, and building partnerships instead of just policing. For those of us who have devoted our lives to this work, that's the kind of change that will keep us in the field and keep children and families better served. Thank you for considering these recommendations.
Thank you. We'll go to Amy Worsbach. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Chair West and members of the committee. I'm Amy Worsbach, and I'm here today as the preschool director of Dodge Nature Center and Preschool. We're a licensed child care center in West St. Paul since 2000. We are NAEYC accredited in a 4-star parent aware rated program. And I'm also here on behalf of Minnesota Early Childhood Outdoors. I know many members wish they could have been able to be here today. So I'm here also today because I care deeply about children's access to learning outdoors, and I appreciate the work that this group is doing to rethink how our licensing and quality assurance systems can work to better support diverse program types. This is my first time presenting at one of these, too. So. At Dodge Nature Preschool, we believe young children thrive in child-centered environments, and we really support play and inquiry. Our curriculum is really driven by interests of children, framed by the natural cycle of the seasons. We really enjoy allowing children to build knowledge through firsthand experiences with nature, classroom materials, animals, and most importantly, their relationship with peers and caring adults. Each year in our parent survey, families share that they choose our program because their children got to gain confidence in being in the outside world. They developed stronger motor skills and imagination and became very comfortable with being outside and interacting with plants and animals instead of choosing screen time. They also share that they've never questioned their child's safety at Dodge and that they love how Dodge lets their children evaluate what feels safe in their own bodies, while also having rules and guidance to keep everyone safe. I really believe children deserve access to both nature and the outdoors and childcare options that will promote their health and safety. However, the proposed licensing regulations may be too rigid and in turn push programs towards one right way to provide care to children. Many licensing and quality standards seem to be written for traditional indoor classrooms with blacktop or commercially constructed playground spaces, not for programs where connection to animals, natural loose parts, and the outdoors are the classroom. The state recognizes the importance of nature access and nature-based early childhood education, including the benefits of time outdoors on its own website. It's important that any new regulations designed to promote healthy outcomes for children utilizing center-based and family-based childcare do not limit or discourage access to the outdoors for children and in turn negatively impact their healthy development. I have three examples of where some of the standards that I'm referring to could unintentionally create problems for nature-based programs. First is just the definition of clean. Historically and currently includes free from dirt. While keeping a clean and organized classroom is important, expecting it to be literally free from dirt has never been fair to providers or children, especially when children are coming in from outdoor play or use dirt in gardening curriculum. Luckily, licensors have been reasonable and understanding. However, this fair and reasonable practice will hopefully continue even if the definition of clean remains unchanged I do worry that it could be read literally and unfairly in the future to limit practices, especially in nature-based programs. Second, nature-based programs rely heavily on natural loose parts and materials, things like sticks, rocks, logs, water play, sand play. These are really essential tools for exploration, but may not fit neatly into regulations that do not differentiate between natural materials and purchased materials. The language in the draft standards currently requires removing materials that might have a sharp corner or a point and/or rotted and split wood. Children in nature-based programs often study cycles of decomposition in nature. A dead log that is rotting can house so many interesting flora and fauna. Additionally, sticks will often have a point that could be considered sharp. In nature-based programs, staff spend time discussing these risks of utilizing materials and how we're going to mitigate these risks. And we've been playing for sticks for 25 years at Dodge Nature Preschool. Am I running out of
time?
Okay, got it. I'll hurry. And our families have appreciated that their children get to learn how to use these materials in safe and pro-social ways. And third, animals are a core part of our program. And children learn by observing and caring for animals, which really support empathy. In the center-based care guidance, there's a call for animal vaccines, which is reasonable for certain types of animals, but there's no guidance about what to do if you're having pets in your classroom that don't have recommended vaccination guidance. So that's just something that should be looked at as connection with animals for children, including fish, turtles, crabs, hermit crabs. Frogs, chickens, and others really benefit their development, and regulations should really be specific on what to do if animals don't have recommended vaccines. So just in closing, I feel like childcare programs in Minnesota are really being squeezed towards a rigid one model, and we're really able to foster safe and healthy environments in nature-based programs like Dodge and have been doing high-quality work for over 25 years. And so just excited about the future, and hopefully we can do more to help allow for those different types of programs. Thank you all.
Thank you. Last on the list is Celeste Finn. And if you can keep it to a tight 3 minutes, that would be terrific.
Thank you, Chair West and committee. This is a difficult testimony for me to give. I never thought that I'd be testifying against recommendations of Think Small. Hello, I'm Celeste Finn. I live in St. Paul, and I'm the founder and executive director of Big Wonder Childcare. Minnesota has education standards that have historically been, we have been very proud of. We all agree children need protection, and they deserve safe care, but perhaps not on quality care. I agree with the testimonies that I heard tonight, but there's one distinction that I think is extremely important and very dangerous. Think Small's recommendation posed grave threat to Minnesota's children. On page 12 of their report, it recommends that quality become optional. Centers would decide if they want to be licensed for quality. As someone who's been in the industry since 2008, this gives me great concern. As we know, childcare is a failed market system. Nationally, profits are 1%. Despite this, the majority of centers in Minnesota are for profit and are driven by capitalistic market. When profits are the primary objective of owners, it is vital that regulations preserve common goods for the well-being of the state. This is true across all industries. I believe any legislation that makes the quality of care children receive optional opens wide the doors for the establishment of warehouses for children. This is comparable to the same health and safety standards as cattle, turkey, and chicken. When 90% of our brains are developed by the time we are five, quality and childcare cannot be an afterthought if we wish to be the educated, successful state we are known to be. We need learning environments and educators who understand child development, executive functioning skills, and behavior management plans. Children need stimulating environments where they can release energy and explore new understandings. This is a time when their brains are weaving new ways to learn. We cannot afford to have Minnesota's children without these supports and structures in place and be prepared for the world they are entering. I have worked in many centers where the quality of care was substandard and the needs of children were overlooked. I watched the light go out. I know how serious and how dangerous this recommendation would be for tens of thousands of children when centers will forego quality in the name of profits. My goal today was to share the grave dangers these recommendations pose to children and families across our state and highlight that there is serious lack of consensus in the sector on this point. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. And Ms. Marjovic, do you have a quick comment, and then we'll get to member questions?
I'm fine to cede my time, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. Representative Sensor Mura.
Thank you. And mine is actually a question about what Celeste Finn just said. And I guess I'm wondering, I heard a reference to something on page 12, I think, of a report that we don't have in our packet. Could the full report be sent out to the committee? And I think I'm just trying to better understand this point about is there a shared floor for quality that comes out of this report? Is that one of the recommendations?
Ms. Morello.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Member, can you repeat your question?
Yeah, so it's just in relation to what the testimony we just heard from Celeste Finn, right, which mm-hmm. I think the concern I had, and I think it's about something that is in a report that we don't right now have access to, so I'm not exactly sure what the wording is that's in the report. But my question is there in the report a recommendation around having a shared floor for quality for child care? Sure. I heard a lot about wanting to have, you know, different pathways and different mm-hmm. accreditation models, but wanting to understand, is there kind of a shared quality floor recommendation? Thank you.
Dr. Smirnoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, so I believe on page 12 of the report, it's the infographic that you got. We can definitely have the report, the full report sent, as well as the background materials. I do want to clarify, first of all, that these are not Think Small's recommendations. These are the recommendations coming from a large group of educators and providers. So just to clarify that. I think what we would respond to is we look forward to future conversations in figuring out what elements of quality remain in licensing and what elements go to a professional-led quality system. In addition to those additional conversations, what we know from research is actually what's most important for children is the professional qualifications of their teachers, so the experience of their teachers, and also those interactions that happen between children and their care providers. And what's actually happened in draft 3 is that those professional standards have actually been removed from the draft. So we've actually already seen the most important part of quality already removed. And so that leaves us with other quality standards in licensing that may or may not make a true difference for children, but maybe they make us feel better. And what we're saying is that those standards are already in licensing right now. So this is not a debate about whether or not we put them in or take them out. They are there. And what we've seen is that they are actually not producing a level of quality, a floor of quality that we'd want to see, especially about professional standards. There are so many variances. From Randy, the Office of Inspector General, his own statistics, there was about 4,000, I think he said this morning in the Senate, variances on professional standards for head teachers and 700 for assistant teachers. That is huge. So whether or not it's in quality, whether or not it's in licensing, it's not producing the quality we want to see. So what we're saying is let's reduce the standards to health and safety where we know children will go to programs. That is the floor. They are going to programs. They are healthy. They are safe. They are getting teachers who are trained in behavior management, in child development, so that because it's hard to keep a child safe if you don't know what's what a child does, what they're capable of. So those things stay in licensing. And then the other pieces that are often duplicative, so we look at parent aware, often duplicative now of what's in licensing. If we take them out of licensing and just put them into a system that is a quality system, then we have more providers who can actually pursue achieving real quality for kids, because now they're not having to show it in two places. Maria is a great example. She has an awesome program, but she has not participated in Parent Aware because it's duplicative of what she's already having to do with the 300 standards in licensing. So that would be my response. There is a bait. The floor, we don't see health and safety as not providing quality level, you know, quality care, but it is a base level of keeping children safe and then putting the other pieces in another place. Thank you,
Representative Sitzer-Murray.
Thank you. I think that answers my question. Just so I'm clear, you're talking about draft three, and you said, you know, the most important in draft three, the most important part of standards are removed. So are you talking about like professional standards for head teacher, assistant teacher, et cetera?
Dr. Smirnoff, you have...
Mr. Chair, sorry. Yes. So, yes, that's what I was referencing, is that research shows us that that is truly what makes a difference for children. So there's an assessment we do. It's called the CLASS, and that measures interactions between children and their teachers, and that really directly maps onto children's outcomes. We know that that makes a difference, but things like that, those types of interactions come through experience and training, and those professional qualifications are no longer in draft three. So, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So on that same point, it's my understanding that this, you know, outline still requires a professional accreditation, and that accreditation would be the acceptable accreditations will be determined by the Minnesota Board of Early Care and Education, led by industry professionals. But that, like, what they determine is acceptable, the child care providers would have to have one of those. They couldn't opt out completely. Is that what is being proposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So accreditation would be one pathway, but what was expressed to us is that accreditation doesn't work for all programs. While there are, I think Minnesota right now has 18 accreditations on the books. We actually, if anyone's interested, we've done a crosswalk to look how those compare to each other. And sometimes those accreditation pathways really don't work for a program. So what we're saying is that accreditation would be one way that a program could show their quality, that they could get their quality recognized, but that the board would come up with alternative pathways, which would also be holistic and validated. We're not saying choose your own adventure, not by any means, but there are other ways to show quality that are not one of those accreditations. Do we feel that accreditation might be the pathway that most programs choose? Yes, it exists. There are resources for it. People know about it. So yes, but again, leaving that door open for innovation, things we haven't thought of, tribally licensed programs doesn't really work for them. So leaving a place for them to be able to work with the board to develop alternative pathways that would be as good as accreditation, that we could feel like in Minnesota, we are comfortable saying this is a quality program through these different pathways. And we are comfortable with the level of quality that all of those achieve. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
And a center couldn't opt out completely and just do, we're going to do the health and safety licensing and nothing else. If you can keep it very short, more members have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. People could remain as health and safety licensed programs only.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much to everyone who's come and testified today. I think part of what makes this really difficult is something that we've seen in the human services space, and we're seeing it in childcare, in that there's a power imbalance that doesn't allow capitalism to work. Parents need care, and we don't have enough providers. And so there's a power imbalance when you need something and there aren't enough people to give it to you that you don't really have choice. And I heard one of our testifiers mention they were the only center in an entire 800 square foot county. square mile, not foot. That would be a very small county, like Massachusetts. Sorry, it is very late in the day for this committee.
Better than 8:15.
But I've had three today. So anyway, I need us to sort of acknowledge that when we are centering this conversation in a space where the power is not equal, it's super hard to have a conversation that makes sense for the end user, which is our kiddos. Because parents need providers, and providers get to choose because there aren't enough of them, because of all of the reasons that we've talked about today. But we're sort of on this circular hamster wheel that I think it's really hard to get off of. And so I just want to sort of acknowledge how hard that work is when the power dynamics are not equal. They just aren't. I would also just sort of caution everybody to learn from previous mistakes in other industries. We've seen in other spaces and in other industries where we've stepped away from the end user, in this case kids, because we really wanted the, and I wrote down like tally marks as we were taught, as people kept saying industry, system, core. When the power dynamic in the industry isn't equal to the end user, we are treading into space that is hard and difficult. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't keep trying, but I would encourage everyone to remember the end user. And whatever choices we make about who decides quality, that board, the structure of it, should be end user heavy and provider light.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Chairman West. Just in regards to the health and safety license recommendation one, just when it points out families define quality, quality seems to be very subjective and ambiguous. I would say a Big Mac is great quality sandwich and hamburger. Freshest tomatoes and lettuce and buns and tomatoes, and that's secret sauce. Others would say that's not a very good quality hamburger, but I would digress, especially with the name McDonald. But isn't that pretty ambiguous? What is quality in this case? And would you agree that I hope that as a community we come together to think, I think we all know, and the families that do this and the businesses, that we know what good quality is. So are you concerned, and I'm not disagreeing with your recommendation, health and safety should always be a priority, but quality, what is quality? I like the one of the testifiers came up and who's behind me now talked about bringing in dirt and they're with the you know frogs and outside and jumping in puddles, because kids love to jump in puddles. That's quality, even though they're bringing in some mud. You know, that's not such quality because they had to clean it up, but that's good quality. So who defines quality other than in your diagram it says families define quality?
Chair, may I address the question?
Ms. Miriam.
Thank you. I think today quality is an illusion in our state. Oh, I know that's shocking, right? But it is. It's an illusion that we've told ourselves, and that is where lack of transparency has been able to creep in here as well. So hearing this question of what is quality and kind of questioning the is the Big Mac quality enough, I do trust that you can choose what to put in your body and that you have people around you who can help support that, whether it's your doctor with a cardiovascular issue or a loved one shedding light on things. But you have people around you who can help define quality. And this system does need people around it helping to define quality in lots of diverse pathways, not one right way, which is what we have now. One right way where incredible programs need 67 variances to exist. Incredible programs. Variances that all of you would shudder at if you looked at the details. And that parents walk into those programs and their hearts open and their children start singing and their eyes light up. And yet they're not able to exist and they struggle like tooth and claw to exist when really that quality is there for everyone to see, even a parent coming in, maybe assessing it as a Big Mac or maybe assessing it as the most amazing burger they've ever seen. But nonetheless, they can make that choice. So if a program existed in this future model that was just health and safety license with this just in front of it, all of us can actually look to parents to understand if we had plenty of supply for them to choose from, They would be able to choose Big Macs if that's what works for their family and the people of support that are around them. And we wouldn't need to judge them for that. And they could redefine what a burger means to them or whether they even eat meat or whether it's made out of plants if they had that option on the table. But today our system doesn't put those options on the table. They have one option among 900 square miles. It doesn't matter how you define quality in that case because I still have to go to work. I don't know if that answers your question, and I apologize for the passion if it doesn't.
Representative McDonald.
Chairman West, yes, thank you. That was very well put. And it did answer my question. And for the record, I'm lucky if I have two Big Macs a year. But I think I'm going to have one tonight because they are good.
Bring them a Big
Mac. But yes, that, I think that's fair enough. I think you make a very good point, and I hope the rest heard you as well.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to be clear. The last testifier talked about there being a trade-off for health and safety. And on page 12, I was reading it. It is posted online. And I just want to make sure that maybe there's some confusion. That's kind of for the family network. It's the mom, the aunt. Is that what you were talking about when you're talking about on page 12, that health and safety component that the last testifier was unhappy with?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Yes. So previously, Dr. Smirlo was pointing out that another component of the We Vision framework is acknowledging our friend and family, neighbor, and other individuals who choose not to go down the licensing pathway, but provide care for family members as nannies, au pairs. And in that case, those families actually are determining this is a quality place for an individual for my child to be receive care. I have a friend, and I just asked her the other day, where does your son go to childcare? He goes across the street to the woman across the street. And I said, oh, she's family, friend, and neighbor. She cares for your son, her neighbors. Yes. And she said, I think she provides great care. So in that case, there is no licensing entity to say that family, friend, and neighbor provider or that nanny is providing quality care, but it's the family that decides based on what their needs are. So, yes, thank you for asking that.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Nadeau.
So, I appreciate this view, and I want to make sure we sometimes, I mean, I think when Representative Coulter and I and others last year we were starting to work on, we worked on this and trying to look at this framework. I mean, I think our intent was to literally pull licensure to health and safety. And I think about food licensing. You know, it doesn't really regulate the quality of the food. It regulates the area that is prepped, the coolness, the temperatures, those things that really don't, they don't deal with whether or not that hamburger is really good or not. It says it needs to be at 160 degrees, but that's really it. And so that's, I think, what we were trying to focus on. And as I'm looking at this, I'm seeing that differentiation of focusing licensure on health and safety, and then separately, that the industry, the educators, the centers, are the ones then that will work through and define theoretical quality as they serve the parents and kids in their centers and in their homes. Am I accurate there, or have I missed something?
May I?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that is true in part. One of the big observations I saw within the We Vision initiative that was created by the Bain and Family Foundation, and they did extensive research and put in years of work in developing this framework. Hearing from the participants in the solution sets that they provide is that, yes, families are getting to choose what quality means to them, but in addition, because they have what you just pointed to, the additional supports, what we saw is that programs actually chose more ways to assess their quality, not less. When there wasn't one restrictive way to show quality, programs said, I chose to show my families that I do provide nourishment and I'm participating in our food program. And I got the class assessment, and I got the environmental rating scales, and this local assessment that is specific to the community that I serve. So what we're seeing is that the initiative itself, the framework, doesn't define quality, but it gives educators the opportunity to choose multiple ways to show the quality that they are providing children in their care. And they do that in part by listening to what families want. So the Early Care and Education Board would also do the same. Listen to what families need and want. Support educators by curating and finding what are those pathways that they can choose to recognize their quality. Not design the pathways, not design the standards. We're not talking about creating another set of indicators. But the board would do the work to say, here are all the ways that you can showcase quality, recognize quality. What do your families need and what do you need to be successful in achieving that recognition?
Representative Doe.
Yeah, and just finally, I just want to make sure that there's a clear separation. Mm-hmm. That was a very long answer. I just want to make sure that there's a very clear separation between health and safety and licensure being here. Mm-hmm. Quality's over here, and it's separate. Is that's yes. where we're going, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, no, please.
Yes.
Please make yes. it brief. Okay, good. All right, we're going to make questions and answers brief from here on out, if you could. Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for your presentation today. I just want to make a couple comments because this conversation reminds me of in the early 2000s when nursing homes weren't going to no longer be the only place frail elderly were cared for. We had a state that was preparing for this tsunami of aging, and so they wanted assisted living. We didn't have assisted living in 2000. Imagine if that didn't happen. I mean, we have now 1,700 assisted living providers. And I say the story because in that setting, in a nursing home, you have to be a nursing assistant, 75 hours of training. When you go to an assisted living, you are trained. I could hire anybody in that setting. I cared for the same people in both settings. I didn't have negative outcomes with either one. It was all training expectations, return demonstration for competency. It goes on and on. And then we have home care. And then we have adult daycare. But my point is we offered choice for the adult children and the aging seniors to find the shoe that fit them best, which I think is really what I appreciate hearing today because, you know, I had the opportunity to go to Norway and see the model in Norway, which it's talked a lot about. And the pieces that I heard overarching, you know, they call kindergarten childcare there, and they start school at 6. But the difference is it's very nature-based. They're all about regulating emotion. They're all about teaching kids socialization skills. It's all through play, unstructured play, where they get to, you know, sled down a hill, climb a boulder. They're not forcing the academic thing at 4. It doesn't mean it doesn't happen. They're matching the child where they're at. But I liked the fact that I saw kids outside in any weather. I asked the question. They are outside every day. It could be 0. It could be they have rain suits, snow boots. I watched it. They are very good at intergenerational education, and that you see grandmothers there working, you know, older than me, and you see all ages. And I don't see that when I go to the child cares today. And so I'm curious as to what we're doing, if you see any pathways for intergenerational programming for that pathways I think are important, and I support that. But I think it's the importance of nature and the importance of all these things, music and all that. I saw that in Norway. I saw that philosophy, and it was on play. And I think while academic is important, but remember, these are 24-month-old children. These are 3-year-olds, 1-year-olds. There is only one time in your life they're that. And their focus is that, and yet when they get to school, you don't see that they don't have successful outcomes on the percentage of kids that can read at grade level. So we do it different here, but we don't see that we're succeeding much in a tremendous way. So I ask us to pause to think about that importance of play. We have 40% increase in mental health for children, too, since COVID. And so social skills and interaction, I think, are imperative. And that bond between siblings, and some families want that, and that's why they choose family child care. They want their children to be together. And then they want to have them go to a center for specialized program, or then they want the after-school program. And I used all of them. So I believe all of them are critical. And I think this is a very important conversation, so thank you. I hope you will consider more feedback on intergenerational programming to have that grandparent feel for children and nurturing. And I think we should consider some of the models that we're seeing for the nature-based programs of Norway, because I saw it and it was pretty phenomenal. So thank you.
Representative Hicks, very briefly.
I'm not good at it, but I'm going to try real hard. So I read the report. I looked at the report. We talked about the board today, and I still don't fully understand. Is this I don't understand the composition of the board. Like, and I struggle with boards where it's really industry heavy and not end user heavy. And I also struggle with boards I don't understand this board's authority. Can you help me better understand, like, who would be on the board and what would that authority look like? Is it advisory authority? Is it decision-making authority? Is it decision-making authority with the legislature? Like, help me.
Dr. Smirillo.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. That is a great question. And again, this will all be fleshed out through the legislative process. So I think that level of detail hasn't been determined yet. The way our group talked about it is that there's a real interest in seeing child care providers and families and experts from the field, so higher ed, so that it would be a real mix of people on the board. As far as the authority, again, that will come through the legislative process. But we see it potentially as the board would make recommendations to the commissioner, who would, barring any budgetary or legislative hindrances, be able to enact what the board recommends. But again, all of this is kind of up in the air as we go through the legislative process. Thank you.
Representative Sensenbrenner? Hmm.
I just got really excited when I heard Representative Zlesnikar talk about Norway because let's do it. And they spend 60 times more on early childcare than we do in Norway. So we in the U.S. spend an average of $500 per child per year, and they spend an average of $30,000. So I'm excited that you went there and saw that. I want that to happen. I think we are emphatically like, let's do it. Let's learn from them. Let's invest in our youngest learners. So I'm excited to hear you say that.
All right. Just quick comment before we close. There's no, this is about Sweden. We absolutely, in order to increase our supply of childcare, we need to address these standards, separating from health and safety, from quality. Massively supportive, I think the majority of the committee is. There is a question of, I don't think that's something that has the option of being only health and safety licensed is going to have enough support to pass through the legislative process. If there is a created new board, I would think that board has the ability, like you want to create an innovative environment, like there needs to be an evaluation so that your innovative environment isn't just showing them marathons of Cheers and then showing them marathons of Scrubs and seeing which child develops better. And so generally super supportive, but I think we do need to make sure that if we go down this route of creating a board of early education, that there is that they evaluate critically and aren't an optional part of the process. We do need to get to the department. I assume you have closing very short sentences. No? Go ahead, Dr. Smith.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for having us here today, and we look forward to future conversations.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll invite the Inspector General up. Which? No one has an orange. Representative Katiza Watoon, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and kind of just in the interest of time and while you guys are getting set up, I did have a couple comments for the committee to consider just as we look at what the previous recommendations may look like, and then as you kind of go into your thoughts about licensing modernization, Mr. Inspector General, there were a couple comments about the health and safety licensing only, and I'm hopeful that you can kind of just give the committee and those in the public observing a reminder of what the process is for friends and family care providers at this point in time. They're not subject necessarily to the same number of ratios. They can only care for a certain amount of children in their home, and whether or not we would have to consider an adjusted ratio if we were to go forward with the situation where families define quality, because I think that is a big part of why we allow family and neighbor providers to care for a smaller amount of children, because they are at this time unlicensed. So that's something that I wanted to just call out as you continue on.
So Mr. Keyes, if you want to address that really quick.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Randy Keyes, Inspector General at Department of Children, Youth and Families. So we have a small number of providers that we call legally non-licensed. But because they want to participate in the CCAP program and accept funds, the federal rules require that they meet the minimum health and safety standards and have background checks. And so depending on the funding that's used, we have to consider whether or not the federal rules will be triggered.
Chair Cattese Batum.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I think as we kind of continue exploring enhanced program integrity and fraud prevention measures, that's definitely something to consider here at the state level as well, but making sure that we're in alignment with the federal government and some of those basic regulations when it comes to quality and health and safety. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for joining us today. We sent you the questions that we couldn't immediately get to the last committee hearing, and I'm wondering if you could address those first. I am happy to. Before getting into a presentation, because I don't want to run out of time. So in particular, the question that I think rises to the top is the new regulations prohibit using any device to restrict or prevent movement or means of discipline or convenience, including high chairs, cribs, and carriers. And with that particular wording, does that mean, like, convenience really makes it apply to a lot of things? And I know a lot of parents, I definitely use the high chair for that purpose, and I always am skeptical when we're asked, we should ask them maybe to do a few things more at a higher standard than the average parent, but this applies, seems to apply in an awful lot of situations. So a provider wouldn't be able to, you know, say a kid's biting another child, they can't put a kid in the high chair while they address that. How does that work, Mr. Keyes?
Mr. Chair, members. So this requirement allows the use of equipment when appropriate and only prohibits using these items as tools for managing behavior or as a substitute for supervision. For example, violations of this requirement include placing a toddler in a crib as punishment for misbehavior or confining a child in a high chair for an extended period unrelated to the mealtime because it's more convenient for a caregiver. The determining factor is the purpose and context of the equipment's use, not the equipment itself. We plan to develop training and interpretive guidance that helps explain a little bit more around these requirements. For your example, I think if you needed to put a child somewhere to ensure the safety of the other child for a brief period of time while you're regrouping, that would be fine. I mean, if a provider wants to put a child in a high chair or a seat for 5 minutes so they can use the bathroom and the child is, you know, so you know the child is safe, That's fine, but we're really concerned about using these as tools for punishment or as a substitute for supervision, where we're just going to put the child in a high chair, we're going to go do other things for 4 hours, and we'll come back. That's not what we want to see.
Okay, that is good. Do you have any comments on these questions that we sent you that you can just go into, or do you want me to read them off?
We can go through it however you want to, Mr. I have them here. I can just sort of work through them.
Okay. I want to make this as efficient as possible for everybody involved.
So the first question we had was around supervision, and it was a question related to being able to provide supervision of school-age children without the aid of mechanical or electronic devices. That's a rule that provision that's in family child care providers. And the definition of supervision requires that the caregiver is available for assistance and care without the aid of mechanical or electronic devices. This means that the caregiver is able to physically provide assistance and care. The rationale is we don't want the provider to be separated from the children by such a great distance that they're not able to intervene. And so one of the scenarios that we hear about sometimes is a provider giving a group of school-aged children a cell phone and is sending them down the street to a playground. Then who's actually supervising the children and how are we ensuring their safety? So that's the idea, is we want the supervision to be active and appropriate. The next question was around the word immediately. It's used in several places in the rules in family child care. One of the places we use it, we're happy to take it out. It talks about destroying the license. But the term immediately is used for situations where time is of the essence in protecting children. We want the child care provider to be able to immediately intervene if an animal shows aggression, for instance, with a child. We also want them to immediately notify the parents if there's an injury or if there's a maltreatment report, right? We don't want to provide, whenever it's convenient, or other languages sort of gives a lot of flexibility. Immediate is not, you don't have to drop the child to run to the phone, but we don't want people to wait because where we put that term, it's important for safety. The place where we have it related to destroying an inactive license, we're happy to take it out there. That's really not about health and safety. Really what we want them to do is stop displaying the license and advertising that they're licensed. The next
apologize
question
to the committee. The questions he's reading off are now in your inbox. That was my bet. Go ahead. That's fine.
The next question was about the department requesting a physical health report for all family providers. Sort of what's that look like? And that requirement's not in child care centers. Part of that's the different structure and how the entities operate. In a child care center, there are other staff present. So if there's a provider has a health incident, there's other people there that can respond. In a family home, generally there's one person providing care. This is already a requirement that's in the rules. We have had doctors send us information that said this person should not be providing care. And so we just want to make sure that the person providing the care is physically capable of doing the work that they're signing up for. Overnight care regulations require all caregivers to be awake. Is the department open to an amendment that would allow caregivers to nap during overnight care as long as ratios are maintained? This is not a requirement in the child care centers provision. It's in family child cares, and the rule currently requires providers to remain awake while there are children in the program. Providers have the option to request a variance to the department if their program has different needs. But it's about what does it mean to be supervising children, and I know this one seems a little tough, but that's sort of where we've drawn the line. We've talked about the one about restricting movement. The next one is around DCYF intending to prohibit separating children under the age of 3, even in order for the child to calm down away from peers. Is there a rationale for this? In family child care advisors, it says under 3. In the child care center's draft, it says infants and toddlers, so that's 33 months, slight difference in age, but it's generally about the child's social and emotional development and their ability to self-regulate. We don't want you to separate the child. We prefer that you engage with the child to help them calm down and be able to, again, participate in activities. The idea that if you separate a child that's 2 or 2, they don't understand exactly why. They just know they're sitting somewhere, and it really doesn't help them sort of address whatever brought on their concerns. So we want you to help them learn to regulate their behavior. The new regulations reduce health consulting from monthly to quarterly. The report cites administrative burden as a reasoning. Can you talk about that some more? As we were going through this process, and I think I talked about this a little bit last week, right, we were trying to figure out how do we balance the demands on the centers, be fair to the businesses, but ensure children are safe. We're trying to set minimum standards, and we think that once the program is up and operating, right, they have to have that health consultant to get their policies in place. We have more frequent visits the first year from licensing staff that they're operating. We're not saying that you can't pay a consultant to come more frequently if you want to do that, but we're trying to provide, we're trying to reduce the administrative and regulatory burden. And one of the, and it involves trade-offs in places. We think this is one where it doesn't adversely affect the health and safety of children to the degree that we're concerned about it.
Thank you for those very good answers. You're definitely not a politician. And seriously, thank you. Representative, we're going to go through a couple of members who had questions, and then we can get to the rest of the report. Representative Hicks.
Thank you. I know you mentioned that the overnight care regulation is current law, which clearly I did not know. So, like, in crisis nursery, you're allowed to sleep. So why are you not allowed? And many of those are child care providers who have taken on crisis nursery options. So why is it okay in foster care and in crisis nursery, but not in this one?
Mr. Keyes.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to phone a friend.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Alexandra Keyes. I'm the Family Child Care Licensing Manager. So in response to your question, the way the requirement is currently written in rule is not as explicit as the way that we've written it here. So there's some ambiguity and inconsistency in the way that the overnight care requirements are applied currently. So what we aim to do at the request of licensors and providers is to make those requirements clear. We don't have a lot of providers who provide overnight care. Our goal was to kind of make it clear what the requirements are. We need the providers to be able to supervise the children. We could look at, as Randy said, a variance if the program needed to operate in a different way. But currently and in the new requirements, providers would be required to be awake.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I would just say that we have a lot of parents who don't work overnights because they can't find childcare, and perhaps the reason they can't find childcare is because nobody can operate on no sleep.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Keyes, just a question regarding your visits to the daycare centers. And then 2025, how many did you visit, and you do it unannounced, that you found any violations or potential violations? And then in regards to, and I'm sure that I know there's a lot of good characters, good daycare providers, centers that are doing good work, but in regards to the Learing Center, had you visited that site before that Nick Shirley fellow visited it in 2025?
Mr. Keyes.
Mr. Chair, members, so are we talking about program integrity visits or licensing visits or combination? Or are we just focused on the one center? I'm going to answer the right question.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Keyes, in regards to page 3, where it says every licensed child care program must be visited at least once each calendar year, I presume a licensed child care program would be in a building of some sort, right? So I guess the question is, either licensure or just any unannounced visit.
Mr. Keyes.
Mr. Chair, members, yes. We had... So if you're referring to the centers that were in the Nick Shirley video, we had, all of them had received a licensing visit that year, and then we did additional follow-up visits after the video was published for compliance visits. In 2025, our licensing staff made 4,036 visits to child care centers. We made 743 visits to certified license-exempt programs. And family child care licensors made a total of 6,248 visits to licensed family child care centers.
And Representative Mr. Chair, the other part of the question, Mr. Keyes, was just how many are you able to disclose the violations that you discovered, if any, at these particular daycare centers, and particularly at that center, that Learing Center?
Mr. Keyes.
Mr. Chair, members, so... all of the licensing violations are published on the licensing lookup website. We can get you the numbers for how many violations there were, in any given place for licensing violations. That's public information. Investigative information is not public, and so We don't have specific information to provide you about a particular center when it comes to program integrity work.
So one lastly, thing that Mr. Chair. I think I can help here a little bit, and then I'll go back to you. One thing that came up during the last visit from the department was a distinction between licensing and program integrity visits. And we asked, well, are they kind of keeping an eye out for fraud, which the answer seemed to be somewhat ambiguous. And one thing we are going to be looking at is making sure that maybe the licensor should do a little bit of a focus on program integrity, because it seemed like there is on your first answer to Representative McDonald was, are you talking about licensing or program integrity? And maybe those should be closer to the same thing, because that is how something could still be visited but not discovered. Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's right on, Chair West. I think the two are integral. I don't think you can have one besides without the other. Wouldn't you agree, Mr. Keyes?
Mr. Keyes.
Chair, members, yes, I agree 100%. And we did the same thing in Wisconsin when we discovered there were fraud. That's part of the way we addressed it, to have the license to go in and do more looks. I've talked to the licensors that work for me and told them in person that this is important. They're a key part of this program integrity work. Every licensor, when they go out on a visit, has an optional form that's available to them to report concerns about program integrity and to share that back. And that's something that they do. And again, that's where we get a lot of our information that leads to investigations on the program integrity side.
And then lastly, Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Key, since you said it's public information, we can look on the website. Would you do me a favor and spare me the time, because time is limited, in particular that center that I mentioned twice now? You said it's public knowledge. Can you disclose today, without us having to look up, what you found, if any, violations of that Learing Center?
Representative McDonald, I don't think we're going to have him look it up right now, but it is pretty easy to Google that. Like, it really... Like, it is right there for us to see. And there are a lot of violations. But
I'll take your word.
Think they need to look that up right now. But there is, like, 40 or something like that. I remember it was immense. But
I'm satisfied, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I just want to make sure we get to finish this. Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the testimony. My question was on page 10, where you have the number of visits for the center, the certified centers, it's all listed out. But of that 4,036 that happened, is that the total number of providers? Was everybody surveyed, or are there some that were not? I don't know if that's the same number or not. Could you please answer that? Mr. Keyes.
Chair, members. I think our number of licensed programs in Minnesota is around 1,800. And so that number reflects that we're required to do at least one visit, and we will follow up if there are concerns that were identified. If we receive complaints from parents about something they saw in a center, then we would follow up with a visit again to investigate that. And so the average, if you look at it, is about 2.5 visits visits per center, but they all required to have at least one visit.
Representative Zalesnikar, follow up. Thank you, co-chair, and thank you for that information. My second question is just more of a follow-up comment to the point of the two reasons you would visit a child care center. It's also similar to the nursing home assisted living model. You have licensing that happens on an unannounced review, and then if there are complaints, the Office of Facility Health Department comes in. But while they're there on a specific complaint, they're also seeing the entire atmosphere. They can see if I have 50 residents there and I have 50 residents on the count. They could see, and if they saw anything egregious, they would be able to have a deficiency, even though they're there for a different reason. And so I would advise parallels in this program, too. Both of them have medical assistance funding. I don't see a reason why it wouldn't be that way, where the licensors and program integrity, to your point, would be in cooperation. Thank you.
Right.
Okay. At this point, there's no other members on the list. We only have a couple of minutes. I'm gonna take the liberty of thinking that the co-chair would call on myself if he hadn't had to step away. And I wanted to ask a question about the comments about co-regulation earlier on in the initial questions that you had been answering on behalf of Chair West. When you are saying that you don't want children to be separated or you know, put in a separate space at a certain point of their development. And I wanted to just kind of clarify a little bit further how that connects to our existing ratios that we have in state law, because the chair and I both have young children at home. And, you know, sometimes I think when as a parent, you are like, all right, I'm gonna put you in your play area, and I know that I can step away and regulate myself, take some deep breaths, listen to a favorite song, et cetera, and then come back and continue parenting. When we're parenting our own children, we have a little bit more liberty to kind of take some of those measures. But when we are trusting care providers to do that for us and there's multiple children in the home, it would seem to me that that is part of the reason why we have the ratios that we do for children under the age of 33 months and then kind of beyond, because if we are going to put every child in their own separate space so that the care provider could maybe regulate themselves, but that child is unable to do so, it feels like there's some sort of a connection there, and I'm hoping that you can maybe just touch on that briefly.
Madam Chair, members, I think as we think about the two different settings that we're talking about, right, in the child care center, if a staff member is struggling, having a bad day, there's someone else that can come in and relieve them for a brief period of time. And they can, you know, come back in when they're ready again. In the family childcare setting, generally there's one provider and a group of children, and that support isn't there. And so that's when it's really challenging, and it's hard to separate children and start to put people in different places. And so we have to work through how do we help the children cope, because we've got to keep the group together so we can supervise all the children.
Okay, thank you. Members, I'm not seeing any other questions. And all right, the chair is rejoining us, but at this point, we're going to adjourn. So look forward to more conversation ongoing, and we will see you back here tomorrow. Thank you.